document was circulated before we went for the media recess or constituency period. So I would want to believe that members have gone through the document and will be able to interact with it as after the presentation by Mr. Khumalo. And I must indicate that a number of members are not here today, but they were all notified of this meeting. And one of the secretaries is trying to find out from them because we've not received any apologies. So I assume they'll be joining us. Unfortunately, we cannot delay any further. So I would suggest that we proceed with the briefing, and if they are still on their way, they will join us. So, without on the agenda, under item number 3 would be the adoption of the minutes, but seeing that will require a quorum, I would suggest that we shift it to be the last item on the agenda, and we can then delete it if at that time we'd have a quorum. So without any waste of time, I would then welcome Mr. Khumalo from the FFC to present to us their submission. Mr. Khumalo, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Just as a way of introduction, I am here with Commissioner Tanya Ajab, who is going to be assisting me with the presentation. And we also have our Parliamentary Liaison Officer, Henry Exton. Let me just take this opportunity, Chairperson, to indicate to you that Commissioner Tanya Ajam is based in Cape Town, and given the kind of pressures that we've been experiencing in terms of our workload in the Commission as a result of the vacancies that we have had in the Commission, Tanya has humbly agreed put in a little bit more hours on the Commission's work, and she will be doing most of the work in our Cape Town office. So you might be hearing from her soon on some of the issues that we would have wanted to have done in the past, but we couldn't because of a shortage of manpower in terms of the Commission. So she will be contacting you as chairpersons of the finance committees on some of the issues, especially emanating from the perception survey that we conducted last year. And we did table a perception survey, a stakeholder perception survey earlier in the year. And so there are some of the issues that we want to follow up on, and she will actually be taking responsibility for some of those things. So she will be spending a little bit more hours in our Cape Town office, even though she's a part-time commissioner. Let me then go into the issue of today. Obviously, the submission is made in terms of the Constitution, in particular Section 214, and also in terms of Section 9 of the IGFR Act, and also in terms of the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act. 2009. It is divided into three major parts. The first part speaks about the macroeconomic and fiscal outlook. So these are issues that broadly speak to the fiscal framework going forward. Part two deals with the issues around local government with a specific focus on urban economies, what we consider to be first phase reports on some work that we've been doing on the issue of rural development, and also on the pressing issue of unfunded mandates. And that basically will complete this submission. Let me move on to the issues around the fiscal framework or the economic outlook. I think we will all agree that the past week or so has been quite filled with a lot of activity, with what has happened in the American economy and also what has happened in Europe and what is still happening in Europe around the financial markets. And we obviously all know from our experience in 2009 what those kinds of events basically mean. Now, what we had identified as we were working on this was that the international economy is still trying to adjust fiscal policy in a very uncertain environment. And if we go back to our submission in 2008, you'll probably be able to pick up some of the issues that we raised around what the implications of a delayed recovery from the international economy would actually mean for recovery in the South African economy. Now, those fears, basically, I think at this point in time, even though they were a little bit far-fetched at that particular point, are becoming more important now as a result of what is currently happening in the international economy. So that basically means that we are still in a situation where we need to deal with the budget deficit in an environment that is very uncertain. And in some countries, issues around the budget process rules have become quite important, an important part of what government actually does, and South Africa is not immune to that. I think the minister, in tabling the budget in February this year, also tabled a set of proposals around possible implementation of fiscal rules, and we have actually looked at that as well as part of the work that we've been doing. And what that would actually do, whether that would actually assist in introducing some certainty in terms of how certain things evolve. So there is some work that has been done by the Commission around that, and there's work that is still ongoing. Now, I think what is very clear, basically, is that fiscal consolidation is still the order of the day. And unfortunately, that has to happen in an era where we have placed very high emphasis on job creation, even though our medium-term forecast will indicate that we need to reduce the budget deficit. Now, what is important then in terms of the job creation would be how we then balance the need on the job creation side and the role of government on the other side. So there's an intricate balancing mechanism that is required there. And I think what is important is that expenditure be redirected into those areas that potentially would be able to create jobs. I have already spoken to the issue of the fiscal guidelines that were tabled by the Minister of Finance in February. And so let me just go back to what the recommendations around this fiscal framework issues or the macroeconomic issues are. Over the medium term, government should continue with the gradual program of fiscal consolidation that entails reducing moderately but consistently the budget deficit. It's not a big bang kind of an approach to managing the process. It's quite sensitive to the demands that are placed, and it's also quite sensitive to programs and new programs that are being introduced. Now, the issue is really about preserving fiscal sustainability, and that means that we need to be wary of what happens to government debt as we roll might find that debt costs basically end up running out of control, and that can mean have serious consequences for the long-term sustainability of what a government actually does. The Commission also supports government proposals to implement fiscal rules. Proper implementation of fiscal rules or fiscal guidelines can contribute to and complement existing fiscal policies. I think in terms of how we manage expenditure or how we manage government spending in general in South Africa, especially as it relates to the sub-national governments, we have fairly strong pieces of legislation that control or just that just put certain measures to ensure that those governments or the sub-national governments key fiscal aggregates are controlled. So, for example, we don't allow for deficit budgeting for municipalities or for provinces. So, we do have those, but in terms of the law, we actually don't allow for those kinds of things. So, already that's like some sign of some rules of some sort in terms of how government's business is actually run. So, we think that those should be strengthened and when one looks at what the minister tabled, we basically say that that's going in the right direction. And also, especially given that we now have the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, that also empowers Parliament to understand what are some of the key fiscal goals or targets that government sets itself, and if there should be any veering away from those, then as long as those rules are there, there's transparency or not government does, and then those questions can then be asked on why you are veering away from the targets that we've actually agreed to. So these are issues that we think are positive for the South African economy, and we need to support that as a commission. Now, it's important, though, how at an institutional level, how we actually implement them. And that is part now of the work that we are currently doing as a commission, who, for example, becomes the guardian of those guidelines or those targets. It becomes an important aspect. So that's something that we are working on, and we should be able to be tabling some recommendations probably during the when we make our submission on the medium-term budget policy statement. There should be some recommendations that would actually be flowing from that to complete this piece of work. The second chapter of the submission looks at some of the key issues that, in terms of what government will be doing, that we must actually take into consideration and what the impact of those are. There's a specific focus on issues of unemployment and relatively low economic growth. There is issues around inequality and poverty. This is quite a big issue if we look at quite a lot of work that has been done by different institutions to highlight this inequality, increasing inequality and poverty as a key issue that government must tackle. And then there's the bigger issue of the Millennium Development Goals, whose deadline is fast approaching us, and we also try to look at whether or not we are on track, and if we're not on track, what must we actually do to deal with those. Obviously, I've already indicated that there are very difficult trade-offs that have to be made in addressing some of these objectives under the economic outlook that we're looking at. These are both at the macro level and also some specific fiscal decisions that have to be made. And then over and above that, we have to look at the roles of the different spheres of government in actually addressing those three key problems that I've actually highlighted on top there. So what we do here is we do a bit of modeling work, just looking at conceptually how we can actually address some of these problems. So there's macroeconomic modeling work that has actually been done here using actual existing data, which takes into account the different spheres' roles in economic growth process, looks at the linkages between productive sectors, demand, and macroeconomic constraints. The assumptions that basically drive the models are forward-looking behavior. So in assuming forward-looking behavior means that you actually take into account the past decisions and in making decisions about the future. So all past decisions and actions have been accounted for in the model. And then we also look at the impact of infrastructure on economic growth. Now, in terms of the finding with respect to the prospects for achieving accelerated economic growth, what it shows is that focused infrastructure spending, which takes into account total factor productivity and employment, results in improved GDP growth going forward. It also reduces the debt to GDP ratio, especially in the medium term. So this basically brings infrastructure at the center or to the center of what government must do in order to address the key problems that I've highlighted in my presentation on the first chapter. With respect to the Millennium Development Goals, what comes out there is that there is an important relationship between Millennium Development Goals number 6, which deals with HIV/AIDS, and Millennium Development Goal number 2, which deals with universal education, in terms of their linkages or impacts on the other or the achievement of the other Millennium Development Goals. So that's education, HIV/AIDS, which deals with mortality. So these are actually quite important Millennium Development Goals, where if you redirect resources towards them, you should be able to make a dent on other Millennium Development. So they've got secondary effects, basically, on the other Millennium Development Goals. Now, the cost of attending all the outstanding Millennium Development Goals is prohibitively high to do within the next 3 to 4 years. And therefore, a prioritization is required, basically. So some of them, you might want to say, let's shift the goalposts. Some of them have been achieved. Some of them, like your universal education, for example, you are at 98% or something like that in South Africa. Now, what that means is that you still have those that are still out there that you must bring into the net, and those are very difficult to get. It's a very complicated process to actually get that last 2% and bring them into the net. We can discuss that if there's a need to, but I think it's very clear that there are reasons for that. Now, with respect to the roles of the other spheres, and here we basically modeled the intergovernmental fiscal transfers, especially in relation to the provincial sphere of government. What is very clear with what the intergovernmental fiscal transfers to the provincial sphere of government do is that they have a very small effect on what happens to economic growth, but they have a significant effect in reducing provincial disparities. What this basically means is that the intergovernmental transfer system at the provincial government level plays a significant role in redistribution. That means the poorer provinces benefit relatively more as you increase the amount of resources going through or flowing to the provinces through the equitable share and the other transfers. And so the role that provinces will play in terms of economic growth, given the current system, is very little. And what that means also is that in terms of your employment creation, you cannot actually rely on those provinces. But in terms of redistribution, which is, we talked about the inequality, That's the question that one can ask. So in terms of the recommendations, what we are saying is that national, provincial and local government should further reprioritize expenditures in respect of their equitable shares and also conditional grants to move towards the attainment of the Millennium Development Goals. Specifically, government should prioritize Millennium Development Goals 2 and 6. In interim, as their attainment will have positive impacts on other MDGs. In other words, the positive spillovers, I've spoken about that. The time frame for attaining all outstanding MDGs simultaneously could be extended beyond 2015 to make the task feasible. Government should continue strengthening the equity focus of the current system of intergovernmental transfers, in particular in health and education sectors. The existing transfer system is not the most effective instrument to support government's growth objectives, and this aspect should continue to be strengthened so that it plays a supportive role in this respect. So what I'm saying is that the current structure of the intergovernmental transfer system, given the current problems that we must resolve, basically needs to be relooked at. That's the basic point that is being made here. We need to take certain decisions on whether we want to continue in the way in which we are going, or we need to review and restructure the system. And I think what is important about this is that 2 years ago, we started some work on looking at the Division of Revenue Bill and what it does, whether it's actually responsive to the intention of government in terms of the outcomes-focused delivery model, whether that Division of Revenue Bill still addresses those kinds of issues was a question that the Commission asked about 2 years ago. And there's been some work that we've actually been doing. And I think quite shortly we will be making some recommendations around what we think should change to try and address some of those issues. And that work basically is being conducted in close consultation between the Commission and the Treasury. But it's really trying to say we have a system that we established around about 98. Is that system still relevant in 2011 now? That is the question that will also be the focus of a conference that the Commission is working towards for 2012, and we will be communicating some details shortly around that. But that will be the focus of the Commission's work going forward. What we need to do to the transfer system in order that it responds to the current demands that government is faced with. Government should also actively and specifically continue pursuing implementation of significant capital investment in public infrastructure that has a positive impact on total sector productivity and employment in the context of the new growth path. Those are the recommendations on that. Let me then move to my last part of the presentation, and then I will hand over to Commissioner Ajam to take you through the rest of this. Now, chapter 3 basically looks at issues around local government. And the first part that I will talk about is really focusing on some works that result from an analysis of the budgets of municipalities. So the focus of the work was on analyzing the revenue and expenditure trends and performance of municipalities. With respect to revenue, there was a specific focus on municipal consumer debt. And then on expenditure, there was also a focus on the factors that influence expenditure and on efficiency. The findings basically indicate that between 2004 and 2009, the real average municipal consumer debt declined for most categories of municipalities except for second making inroads with respect to this challenge. There remains room for improvement in a number of areas. These areas include the management of debtors, accounting for indigence, affordability of basic services, billing and collection activities. It was also on the expenditure side clear that municipalities spend very poorly on repairs and maintenance. There is a poor costing of services, and then there's also needs to be a distinction between social and economic infrastructure. Municipalities need to improve technical efficiency in utilizing existing resources. There's a skewed resource distribution, service delivery arrangements in terms of provision of basic and free basic services and skills levels in municipalities impact on efficiency. Now, this work around the sectors influencing efficiency is also based on a modeling exercise that basically took into account a number of factors and models looked at how municipalities, different sets of municipalities perform under different types of assumptions about the factors that might actually influence spending. And you could, for example, look at the stability of the management in a municipality. So you look at the relationship between a stable municipality in terms of management, between municipal manager and chief financial officer. If those people have been in a municipality for a certain period of time, it seems to suggest that those municipalities that have had stable and qualified municipal managers and CFOs have tended to perform better than those that have rapid turnover around those areas or less qualified municipal managers. So those are the kinds of exercises that we conducted here. Now, what we know is that the Treasury is basically have started the process as part of their support to municipalities, a process of benchmarking municipal budgets. And we think that these benchmark exercise that both National Treasury with a number of the bigger municipalities and metros and provincial treasuries with the rest, we are of the view that those benchmark exercises are quite a critical component and they can be used as a tool to incentivize effective financial municipalities amongst management. If you publish that this municipality does not budget properly, and this municipality does budget properly, and you make it public knowledge, we do think that that can actually provide an incentive towards other municipalities, those that are not performing so well and those that are performing well, to actually learn from each other. And we think that this result of these evaluations should be reported to Parliament and provincial legislation to assist the process. There's an issue around the compliance with legislation, and I think I must say here that last week I had a discussion with one of the metros around this particular issue, and it seems to me that obviously the problem is bigger than simply municipalities complying with the legislation, especially in the setting of tariffs, but it's about balancing what a municipality must do in terms of the legislation with what actually happens in terms of processes around managing the impact of tariff increases. So this is a matter that we raised strictly from a legislation point of view, that tariffs must actually reflect the cost. Now, what comes out in discussions with some of bigger metros is that the cost might actually, from a municipality's point of view, costing might actually be based on that. But when you go out to then consult, the political process can actually result in a different kind of an outcome. Now, we need to balance that. Now, we can ask ourselves questions whether so there's an issue that is there, but it's a recommendation that we are making that that should actually be complied with. The next recommendation is that national and provincial government should require the municipalities to identify the primary cause of poor performance in billing and revenue collection functions and use the information to design appropriate remedial strategies. As an interim measure, government should establish and publish guidelines for municipalities on management of municipal consumer debt in terms of, but not exclusive to, interest charges, debt impairment, and writing off of bad debts. National and provincial government should develop and support peer learning and support programs that assist poorly performing municipalities to leverage experience and best practices of well-performing municipalities, particularly in relation to spending, performance, efficiency in using resources, proper debt management, and achievement of desired developmental outcomes. And finally, data available at local government level should be reviewed to ensure appropriate surveys or alternatives available to account accurately for changes in demographics and other factors at a municipal level. I think this is a recommendation that we simply reiterating on the basis of the fact that most of the local government data is driven by census data that is actually very, very outdated. And with the rapid pace of urbanization that is actually taking place in South Africa, there is a feeling from the Commission's perspective that maybe we need to balance the census data with the other types of surveys. It's difficult for states to be able to do that, and we need to explore other options that will still involve that essay to ensure that the data, whatever data that is collected, also is credible and can actually be used in the types of areas that we need the data for with respect to local government. Can I then hand over, Chairperson, to Commissioner Ajam to take you through the rest of the submission?
Good morning, honourable members. Chair, you will forgive me if I'm not as clear as I would like to be because I'm recovering from bronchitis, so I beg your indulgence in that. Chapter 4, focus on vibrant urban economies. And I think we all agree that economic growth in the cities is absolutely critical for sustainable development and economic growth of the whole country. Unfortunately, in South Africa, the way we use land, especially in cities, is very inefficient. And we have very low density levels. And this challenge needs to be addressed as it has overall impact on the sustainability of resources such as land and is costly to the overall economy. So, for instance, because we have these very sprawling cities with low densities, what one finds is that people live far from where they work. And if you look at the poorest households, they spend a disproportionate amount on transport. So it's not very equitable. But from a fiscal point of view, what you find is that you might find that in human settlements, we're not buying well-located land because the well-located land, which is in the centers of the city, is tends to be on cheap, affordable land. So we do that because of constraints in the human settlements budget. But yet we are paying more in the transport subsidies budget, in the transport budget. So it's very important to look at it not through separate budget votes, but to look at the overall fiscal cost that is accruing to government. The other crucial area is whether public services are sustainable. There are certain public services which require a certain threshold density of people to actually be sustainable. For example, public transport. So if you can increase density, it also makes public transport more viable. Now, very little systematic research has gone into what are the fiscal and economic costs of inefficient land use. And this is a project that the FFC has started, and these are some of our recommendations, but we will be unpacking this issue much more systematically in the future. What we're concerned about is that there are various pieces of legislation which acknowledge the importance of densification to promote efficiency. But are there incentives in the fiscal system to actually promote densification? Okay, let me give you an example which I alluded to earlier. If you want more dense construction, it typically is more costly than low density construction. So you might find that the cost of the land might be more expensive. The cost of building those top structures, for example, apartment buildings, might be more expensive. But you might be decreasing transport subsidies costs as well as costs to individuals because it's more convenient for them to be close to where they live and where they work. So this is an issue of concern to the FFC. Current funding for the built environment is uncoordinated and doesn't support the delivery of integrated and sustainable human settlements or with basic infrastructure. So what the FFC has done is commissioned a model which tries to model what are the impacts of spatial decisions on the fiscus and on economic costs to different types of commuters, different types of households. And that model has shown that a sprawling city is more costly than a compact city. Cost savings in a compact relative to a sprawling city amount to 7% after 10 years. And if this is extrapolated to 6 metros, then the saving amounts to approximately 1.4% of GDP by year 10. Not only will a more dense, compact city reduce costs to the fiscus in the long term, even though it might increase costs in the short term, but it also has got a much better outcome for climate change. So the more compact your city, the less traveling one needs to do, the less carbon emissions, the lower the city's carbon footprint. So if you look at the modeling that the FEC has done, that model suggests that there will be a 22% less carbon emission resulting from more efficient public transport and less traveling. Right. So there are both environmental and fiscal and quality of life benefits associated with a more compact city. But unfortunately, that requires a very coordinated response from government across all three spheres and across sectors, which may not be there at present. It may also require higher costs in the next couple of years in order to save costs in the longer term, which is a factor we need to consider. So our recommendations in that regard is that government should actively and specifically pursue development of a more spatially compact urban form for cities by developing and adopting appropriate policies and financing instruments. These could include wider use of development charges in financing infrastructure associated with the land development process. Members will recall that there is also a spatial and land use management bill which specifically tackles the issue of development charges. The public transport subsidies that specifically target high-density, low-income areas and fiscal incentives for urban land development projects located within the existing urban form. So in other words, these would be infill projects that are filling in underutilized spaces within the current city limits. Government should also review the Commission's analytical work on fiscal and economic costs of the current urban form of cities and guide the Commission as to further development of these analytic methods. Government should conduct a broad-based review of the efficiency of the current housing finance arrangements in meeting housing needs within the context of creating sustainable and more compact human settlements. The cost of climate change is also important, as I alluded to earlier. Unfortunately, we don't understand what those costs to local economies are. Our chapter presents our preliminary work where we try and look at costs associated with climate change in the local government sector. And using an econometric model, our preliminary findings show that climate change is a real threat to water and energy security in the local government sector. So what happens is that climate change induces variability in rainfall, for instance, which could increase water and electricity demand and thereby increase demand for water and electricity infrastructure expansion, which would have a direct impact on city budgets. This may mean that municipalities may have to forego essential services as they stretch their budgets to cater for these climate change consequences. The FFC recommends that government should ensure that municipalities develop their own climate change mitigation and adaptation strategies and plans for climate change as part of the IDP planning process. So we're saying that there shouldn't be a separate set of plans, but each municipality's response should be factored into its existing IDPs and sector plans. And this should obviously support what is happening at national level as well. Government should provide support in this respect to municipalities over the next 3 years, distinguishing between different types of municipalities by both location and capacity in terms of the mandatory requirements placed on them. Government should consider providing municipalities with a performance-based conditional grant which rewards or incentivizes actions that are environmentally efficient and responsive to adaptation and mitigation challenges of climate change. The design of the proposed grant should pay attention to municipal-specific factors such as the area, topography, coastal, or otherwise, and vulnerability to climate change. Specific focus areas for this grant should include efficient water management practices, including minimization of water losses, effective asset management of water infrastructure or rehabilitation programs, and demand management. Efficient energy management practices, including minimization of electricity losses, unaccounted for electricity, elimination of illegal electricity connections, and energy savings by households and industry, as well as implementation of green procurement principles. From the city-urban side, we move on to part three, which is the theme of improving development outcomes of the intergovernmental fiscal relations system. What this chapter looks at is factors which inhibit the quality of service delivery, performance of subnational governance, and developmental outcomes of public expenditure, which is channeled through the IGFR system. And it explores the introduction of governance, institutional, and financial innovations in the delivery of government services. Outcomes of public expenditure has emerged as a major concern for all policy makers. These include fiscal leakages and waste, cost overruns, for example, as a result of OSD, the occupation-specific dispensation, and poor service delivery outcomes resulting in inefficiencies. Public sector spending on basic education and health, for instance, has been rapidly increasing since 1994. However, the rate of return and impact of this investment has been much less than what was hoped for. The FFC therefore recommends that government should finalize the implementation of OSD and formalize the performance evaluation system. Because the wage bill is such an important and fiscally significant item in government's expenditures as a whole, it's typical, it's important that this line item be managed as effectively and efficiently as possible. In dealing with the expansion and implementation of OSD, the FSC recommends that government should be mindful of the rising public sector wage bill relative to other priorities. Rethink the funding of personnel costs, which are centrally determined but funded by provinces through the provincial equitable share. There should be full costing of OSD implementation, and national government must take responsibility for funding, preferably through a specific purpose conditional grant. There should also be formalized performance evaluation with the aim of boosting performance by emphasizing high competence of education and health personnel. Increases in education spending should be directed towards investments that will have the biggest impact on improving quality. These include learner and teacher support materials, and government should improve the quality and prioritize epistemological access to education by developing capacity to evaluate academic performance of learners throughout their academic careers, ensuring that the required amount of time is spent on teaching by relieving teachers of administrative duties through the hiring of administrative assistants, supporting training and development of teachers and making explicit the amount spent for this purpose through the Division of Revenue Act, and improving schools' accountability for learner performance. Coordination, financing, and provisioning of scholars' transport should be improved. Honourable members will recall that the FSC has raised this issue in previous recommendations. The Commission is aware that agreement has been reached between the Departments of Basic Education and Transport that scholar transport function should be transferred to the Department of Basic Education, from the Department of Basic Education to the Department of Transport. In doing so, it is recommended that all resources associated with delivering the service associated with scholar transport are transferred to the Department of Transport, including current assets and budget and all future resources, and that a thorough assessment of the financial and fiscal implications of this function shift is conducted before the shift happens. Government must, through input norms and standards, take reasonable measures to give effect to inclusive education of intellectually disabled children. These norms should indicate human, physical, administrative, and regulatory resources provided by government dedicated to achieving targets for inclusive education. No doubt members will be aware of the High Court cases that took place between NGOs in the Free State against the Department of Social Development, and there were also similar cases in the Western Cape regarding intellectually disabled learners and resources allocated to them. Both court judgments indicated that the funding arrangement should be reviewed with a view to assessing adequacy. Government should extend its ongoing efforts to reform health fiscal frameworks by taking into account the burden of disease, giving rise to budget pressures to cover the review of funding of HIV/AIDS, opportunistic and other infectious diseases through a regular review of usage costs for chronic diseases services in HIV/AIDS, TB, maternal and child health in order to inform resource allocations to the public sector healthcare system. Institutionalization of a budget process that forces provincial health budgets to be based on estimations of needs of healthcare service users and holds provincial government accountable for the underfunding of hospitals and clinics. Re-examination of distribution of resources between different levels of care without weakening the role played by tertiary hospitals, but also strengthening the role played by primary healthcare in the health system. Certain functions such as procurement, human resources, and financial management should be devolved to hospital management in order to boost efficiencies and to better performance. In terms of rural development, as Bongani mentioned earlier, we haven't made specific recommendations on those areas, but we have released our preliminary findings. The governance and institutional arrangements for rural development across the three spheres of government needs to be clarified urgently. This is important for planning, budgeting, and implementation for the rural development programs. The Commission recommends that a functional mapping of all rural development activities be undertaken with specific responsibilities assigned to each sphere of government. So in other words, we need to know who's doing what and who's accountable for delivering what across the area of rural government, agriculture, and cutting across all the three spheres of government as well. The fiscal framework, both the equitable share and the conditional grant allocations for rural and agricultural development must be reviewed. In particular, government should merge current conditional grants into a comprehensive agriculture and rural development finance program, preferably administered by one department, in order to improve focus, targeting, and impact of those grants and reduce transaction costs in their administration. In respect of unfunded mandates, government should take steps to ensure that all mandates have a legal basis, that the functions performed by each sphere of government has a secure legal footing. Performing functions outside of their budgets or of their mandates impinges on the lawfulness of budgets of municipalities and provinces, although the expenditure is not necessarily illegal. Government should develop a time-bound program to regularize the functional assignment of libraries and museums. Government should undertake a review of the extent of compliance with legal procedures for the assignment and delegation of functions, such as set out in the IGFR Act, the FSC Act, the Division of Revenue Act, and the Local Government Municipal Systems Act. It is recommended that compliance with the following legal requirements are assessed. Financial and fiscal implications of the function shift on a sphere of government or organ of state. The organ of state which is initiating the general assignment must provide these implications for the FFC for its recommendations to the Ministry of Finance in line with Section 3 of the FFC Act of 2003 as amended. The FFC tables a compliance checklist which can be used as a tool for this purpose. Honourable Members, we often find that the FFC is introduced to processes at the tail end, and this precludes us from giving systematic assessments and advice on the fiscal and financial implications. All resources associated with delivering a service in a function to be shifted must also be transferred. These will include current assets, budgets, and all future resources. There must be evidence of a decision taken by the executing authority of the assigning or delegating department that this state is acknowledged and pledged. And that basically is just saying that resources and budget and finance should follow function. So to conclude, the main themes in the Commission submission for 2012-2013, these are the support for continuing fiscal consolidation, the support in principle for the adoption of fiscal rules or guidelines, prioritizing MDGs to improve the quality of spending in order to impact on job creation, global poverty, and cushioning the vulnerable, and addressing municipal challenges, including issues of urban form and climate change through the adoption of sustainable long-term strategies. I think I will hand back to the Acting Chair now.
Thank you, Tanya. I think Chairperson and honourable members, that's the essence of our submission. I must say that we intended to have published the technical report at the time of tabling the submission, but it's actually taken a little bit longer. The technical report is on the website, and the published documents will be available in a week or so. But we have put a technical report that supports the submission on our website, so it's actually available. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kumar and Commissioner. Honourable members, it's time for questions for clarity or engagement. Makubela. Chairperson, I'm only having only one question for clarity. The issue of stats, Mr. Kumalo, you are saying, I think there are other options should be employed. What are those other important options, if you may tell us, in order to be on that line, said, all right, these other options which may sometimes have be helpful in order to get the proper state. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I hope that after the questions of clarity, we're still going to find time to discuss certain issues. And of course, yes. Okay. Page 14. That recommendation that talks to the transfer of the function of scholar transport from Department of Education to the Department of Transport. A very tricky situation. Very tricky. I'm not sure whether we have applied all our minds to the core. I just want to check, you know, it's what informs FFC to take this particular position. Given the situation that other departments currently have problems with public works, just simply to be able to achieve their own goals. Relying on public works, and then we have got contradictions that emerges. Now, with this specific one that talks to education and transport, have we entertained the possibility of clashes in terms of numbers of educators to be transported vis-à-vis the requirements of transport by the Department of Transport, having clashes on the ground? And of course, what we're saying is that in education, that educators must stay away from other non-core activities. They must concentrate on education. Your position will assist us in getting educators too. But this other related problems that will emerge when schools are even failing to provide correct statistics for buying books for themselves, what's going to happen? What informs your position? And
thank you, Chairperson. Thank you also to Mr. Kumalo for presenting this report to us on their recommendations. 2009, in the briefing we received from the FNC, page 5 at the bottom was a paragraph referring to this intergovernmental fiscal relations and transfers. As if I see the paragraph in front of me now. And this thing is coming up every year when we deal with this subject. The point is, we must come up with a solution. And I would like to hear from Mr. Kumalo, how do they see what must happen to improve what must improve? One of the things we come across when we visit provinces, and I speak for my own province in Northern Cape, is the duration of time for money to be transferred from national treasury to the provincial treasury to COCTA, and then from COCTA to a municipality. It nearly took 4 months in the case of Kerwel-Wagland. I want to tell you, we're living in the era of IT and everything that is electronic. Why must it take 4 months to do those transfers? To get something done at grassroots level, to improve the lives of people, because that is the objective. That's one issue we will have to address when we address the MDGs. And I believe there's a workshop next weekend. What are your proposals on this? Otherwise, next year we're going to talk about it again. The whole thing about skill shortages. We will have to zoom in on this. Shortage of nurses, qualified nurses, the present training facilities are too small. We can only address it when you can have a bigger intake, more lecturers, and put a lot of people into the labor market to go to the job. The same with doctors. So I'm just highlighting this point. Thank you, Chair. But thank you for this presentation. I went through your think document as well regarding your recommendations. I would like to hear the treasury side of it. Thank you.
From my side, Mr. Kumalo, the Commissioner, I just want to, you see, I've been trying to have a clear understanding, because there seems to be, in fact, there is a consensus in the country that South Africa is a very unequal society. And each time we talk of these inequalities, unemployment comes into picture.
those who are employed, then we always would raise the issue of the gap between highly paid and low paid, which exacerbate these inequalities to a certain extent. But I just want to hear, if you may share with me, in the context of those challenges of inequality in this country, what exactly are we talking about when we talk of inequality, and what exactly do we intend as a country to achieve on tackling this whole thing of inequality? I'm asking this question because much as I understand the context in which it is raised, but just raising it so that other people have tend to make it a slogan to mobilize people around certain things. But I'm not sure if whatever that you want to achieve, even after achieving it, will ever come to a situation where we say we are now an equal society. In fact, I have never heard of any equal society. I'll be pleased if anybody can tell me that, no, if you go to, we want to be like country A, people there, they are equal in terms of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's why I'm now interested to know exactly what are we talking about when we talk about this inequality and what we want to achieve out of it. Thank you.
It looks like already you are in the discussion, sir.
No,
Should we proceed on that?
No, let's get
out of here. Okay.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, honorable members. Let me start with the first question on the stats. I prefaced with my discussion of that with a submission that the commission has made. So I'm saying that that issue on the data is actually not a new recommendation that we're making. We made an extensive set of recommendations in 2007 around this particular matter. One of those recommendations basically was the establishment of a local government data collection and coordinating a forum that would then be recognized as a particular institution within the local government sphere that provides data support. At that particular point, we were finding that there was quite a number of demands for data from municipalities. And each, I think, in terms of the kind of numbers, we were looking at the number of questions that municipalities or municipal managers had to fill in order that a government department or an institution like the Financial and Fiscal Commission, everybody wants something. But we all ask the same question in different ways this number of times, and municipalities would probably get to a point where why must they keep on answering the same kind of a question from these different institutions? So it's just rationalizing the information and then also ensuring that the information that is collected at that level can also be utilized for other purposes rather than just what the FFC wants the information for. If it has to be utilized in that particular way, there has to be some way of vetting that information to ensure that this is credible information, it's objective information. It's not just being collected to serve a specific purpose or a specific interest of a municipality. So, for example, if you look at the demographic data within a municipality, the municipality will have its own database around that. Now, whether that information is required for this particular purpose or for that other purpose can be very open to manipulation if there's no external process of ensuring its credibility. So you don't want to be found to be using that kind of information, for example, to allocate resources without having checked on the credibility of that kind of information. So what we're saying is that different municipalities and different institutions within local government, for example, the cities network, collect quite a number of surveys and collect different levels of detail and information around the cities. But do we utilize that type of information for the purposes of making allocations, for example, to municipalities. That's another question that we must ask, because the cities network has specific interests in why it actually exists, whereas government on the other side has a specific interest in it. So the kind of information that you utilize, if it is not subjected to any specific checks and balances, can easily run away with the situation on the basis of interest groups. So that's what I'm trying to say, that all of these options that we have are there, but how can we formalize them so that we can actually be able to utilize that kind of information without necessarily putting excessive demands on state SA to collect information in this particular way at this particular interval, if we can actually have other options that are available, which might actually reduce the burden from state SA. So that is the context of that discussion, Honorable McQuarrie. The second set of issues, the transfer of the scholar transport function. And now I will take you back, Honorable Mashile, to the Commission submission in 2007, again. We conducted an extensive review of the state of learner transport across the 9 provinces, and what we found was that there were in certain provinces, it was the education department that was responsible for provision of learner transport. In the other provinces, it was the transport department. But in terms of allocation of resources, if you go into the province and then you ask questions about the allocations for learner transport, you also found that different approaches or different allocations were existing across the province. So there's high levels of inequality that simply because this one province maybe does not take learner transport as an important function, they allocate certain amount of resources. So you would find that even the mode of transporting learners would also vary across provinces. So in some provinces, you would even find donkey-pulled carts being used to transport learners to school. In other provinces, very old buggies, and in other provinces, nice buses that are normal types of transport. So there are safety issues there. So across the board, you find these inequalities. Now, the one issue that we raised in that particular submission was we need to identify the location of the function, who is responsible for it, so that even if you have to check the allocations going there, you know exactly where to start. And then, obviously, if there is one department, then there is one set of norms and standards that must actually be implemented. So you can actually look at it from a national level. There are norms and standards for school funding. If you look at those, you would find that the Minister of Education must actually delegate that to the MEC for Education. But there are national norms and standards that are established for scholar transport. When do you begin providing scholar transport? For example, what is the distance between the school and the place of residence of learners? So the implementation basically is happening at the province. But if different departments are actually handling this, then there's a problem of actually trying to look at this uniformity and ensuring that you actually meet those uniform standards across the board, the minimum standards that are required, whether it's about safety or it's about the distance, it's about how much you spend. Now, earlier this year, I sat in a discussion, a briefing by the Department of Transport to the Standing Committee on Appropriations, where it was then raised that now that matter, because we had raised as one of the recommendations that we must actually clarify whose responsibility it is between national education and transport. And a high-level meeting was convened by the ministers and following that set of recommendations and the DGs, relevant DGs, and ultimately they agreed that the function must now reside with the Department of Transport. So we picked that up from there, that it's now a decision that's been taken, because that's a policy decision. As a commission, we can't actually do anything about it. But understanding, with an understanding of what is actually happening at the bottom, at the level of implementation, and at the level of allocation of resources, we then revisited that a numbers, and we still found that there were significant discrepancies in terms of the allocation across provinces. And obviously, if there are those significant discrepancies, it means that at one province there's maybe underfunding of the function, and at another province there might be sufficient funding of the function. Now, if you transfer that from the one department to the other, what happens in terms of our responsibility as a commission is whether or not the resources that actually are transferred with the function are consistent with what is actually required in order to continue with the service. Now, where there is underfunding already, it means that even if you say funds follow functions, this education department, let's say maybe which was providing this function, must transfer whatever it was allocating to the transport department. Now, if it was already underfunded, then we have no idea what the actual requirements are going to be. And the likelihood is that, looking at the provincial processes, and the likelihood is that you might not actually correct that imbalance that you already have. So it's important that there is a proper assessment of what the actual requirements are going to be before the function can actually be shifted from the one department to the other. Otherwise, it perpetuates the underfunding. And in terms of the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act, that is a specific requirement. And if these two departments actually embark on that kind of a process, and the commission has not actually been apprised to make its own recommendations to the Minister of Finance, in terms of the FFC Act, there's non-compliance. Section 3. So that is where the commission is coming from. Now, so whether or not we actually have applied, we have certainly applied our mind. We applied our mind way back in 2000. We started the work in 2005, I think, if I'm not mistaken, just looking at some of these vulnerable programs, which when there are serious budget constraints, those are the first programs to basically be cut. And we started looking at it in that kind of a context, and we really found that there were serious issues that were actually happening. So the work is not new. It's basically reiterating some of the process issues that we must actually go through in order that we can actually address that problem that we have identified. In response to Honorable DPS' question about what we must do with the intergovernmental fiscal transfer system and what needs to be improved, I think, this can take a whole day. That is why my reference to this, I also referred to some of the work that we want to do in the form of a conference coming up in 2012, and Commissioner Ajam here reminded me also that we are planning on having a public hearing that as a commission we will actually host very shortly, actually in the next month or so. We will be hosting some public hearings specifically, firstly focusing on the fiscal system for local government. And so some of the recommendations that we have made in the past that we know are still sitting there, even though somebody somewhere said, no, we agree with the FFC and all of that, and they have not been implemented. And there are also some of the inputs that have been made by different sectors of our society around what we must do, why we must review the equitable share formula, why we must do all sorts of things. So it's a whole range of issues. And I think the key issue, Honorable Tipia, is to actually ask the question about whether or not a system that we introduced in 2000, for example, if you look at the local government issue, which is what you raised, that we introduced in 1998, with the first local government, let's say, equitable share formula and set of conditional grants that were sitting in different departments. I think now, in some circles, we are almost going back full circle. Some people are beginning to say that we must actually put these grants, instead of having a single infrastructure grant, we must actually split it and put different components under different sector departments. But we came from there, and we knew what the problems were at that particular point in time. That was before the democratic local government, for lack of a better word, was introduced, and before some clarity in terms of who is going to be responsible for what in terms of the functional assignments and all of that. That's way before those were actually in place. Now, when those actually came into place, we then had all these set of recommendations that put this together, and then we left it like that. By 2005, we had now a set of recommendations that spoke to the local government, the equitable share formula, and then we left some of those things hanging out like that. So, for example, there's the issue of the development component in the local government equitable share formula. That has been sitting there. It's set at zero, and so on and so forth. So we can go on the whole day trying to talk about these things. But I think the key issue is the demands that we have today for government and the service delivery model that government has adopted. Surely, the system that we put in place in terms of the intergovernmental fiscal transfer system, which must support the delivery model that government has, it can't be just a coincidence that it actually speaks directly to that. I think there is just on the basis of that, before we think about what is wrong with the current system and what can we change, just on the basis of the delivery model and the institutional arrangements around it, the intergovernmental fiscal transfer system is not consistent with that. So that's one area that we think we need to actually interrogate quite substantially if we have to address some of the problems that we have had or that we have experienced in the past as we move forward. I'm sure Tanya will add on to that. Now, on the issue that you raised, Honorable Chani, around unemployment and inequality and what it is that we must do, I think it's a very complicated question as well. In some circles, people talk about the developmental role of the state. Now, we are all aware that we inherited a system which was inherently unequal. And in trying to address the legacy of the apartheid government and the concomitant inequality in the system, we set in place certain programs of action, including education. We recognize that education can assist in pulling people out of poverty. We introduced uniform and free access to primary health care, basically. So you rolled out a lot of programs that actually, and then we also have created a very sophisticated and massive social assistance program through the grants, through the other welfare services that out of which Commissioner Ajam made reference to. So we have all of those things that we put in place to try and address the issues of poverty and inequality. Now the hope was that the economy, the broader economy, would actually respond in a positive way, so that as the economy grows, the output of the education system of well-educated, healthy people would also be actually absorbed by the economy. But things have not worked out in that particular way. The kind of economic growth that we have experienced is one that is also tends to be labor saving. It's not the kind of growth that is accompanied by massive employment opportunities being created. So there has been a structural issue around the economy. Maybe one might want to break down what are the sectors that have driven economic growth in South Africa and whether or not, those are sectors that indeed create jobs. But on the other hand, in terms of the big programs that I've made reference to, our health system is not performing very well in terms of outcomes. Our education system is also not performing very well. So we're producing a lot of people, we're sending a lot of people to school, but we can't use them in any useful way. So now the social expenditure system must be the one, so your social assistance program must be the one that now try and close that poverty or unemployment gap. That's not very sustainable. So the question then comes back, brings me back to why I'm saying that this issue around what is the developmental role, or what is this whole concept around the developmental state that we try to look at. And frankly speaking, the growing inequality is a question of access to resources. And those that have the resources will basically now, if they are not part and parcel of the broader objective around how we actually deal with this, there is a problem. So there are empowerment, economic empowerment programs that government adopted, which have not necessarily yielded the specific objectives that in certain circles people refer to our economic empowerment programs as economic enrichment programs. So there's a race for that, which actually also is a critical area that you must actually address. If we say economic empowerment, what exactly do we mean? Is it about giving people work tenders so that they can actually make money? Or is it about making sure that those people actually play a meaningful role in the economy? Maybe we targeted the wrong kinds of sectors for our economic empowerment programs, as evidenced by some of the problems that have afflicted the mining industry. If you look at the types of mines that find themselves under significant pressure, it tends to be those mines that are black economic empowered. Those are the mines that basically feel the pressure first, rather than the. So there are all of those issues that are about the economic structure and who actually controls the resources that actually matter as we move forward. Then there's also the issue of those that actually are employed and what the benefits are, and whether or not those that are in current employment are prepared to make sacrifices so that certain... And I think government has taken certain decisions around what sacrifices must be made in the public sector, especially at high level in terms of remuneration and all of that. What sacrifices must be made as we move forward in order that our personnel budgets basically do not grow as fast as possible, but we also have productive investment by the state that would actually generate or open up opportunities for other people to get into the job. Let me just stop there and ask Tanya to respond to some of the...
I just want to respond to Honorable De Beers' issue. If I understood it properly, it was that we've been raising issues about intergovernmental transfers for some time now. So we've done the diagnosis. When are we going to actually see a remedy or a response? And I think that listening to the example that you made, for example, how long does it take between when appropriation is made by Parliament and when it actually hits the municipality's bank account? I think those types of issues relate to the implementation of the intergovernmental system. How is it actually being implemented? And what we've noticed, even from the Auditor General's report, is that you have a Division of Revenue Act, but there's widespread non-compliance with it and very little enforcement of it. Right? So I think that the first step to answer is what can be done within the current arrangements to actually just speed it up. Right? And I think that we have a project on the Division of Revenue Act with the National Treasury to try and say, within the current mechanisms, how long is it actually taking? You've given one example, but we need to have a bird's eye view on that. The second question is, how can the design of the intergovernmental grant system be improved? And the problem here is that you can't design intergovernmental grants until you actually know who's supposed to be doing what, and how many provinces and how many municipalities are they supposed to be. So what we've had for the last 2 years is there's been basically a kind of a policy vacuum, because we know that changes are afoot, but we're not certain what those fundamental changes to the structure of government are. And until you actually know that, you can't begin to nail down how you would structure your grant system. But as my colleague, the acting chair, mentioned, we're hoping that we can at least kickstart a more focused dialogue on this through the public hearings that we want to hold.
Mashile, Honorable Sisi, you are welcome. You are free to participate. You will follow after Honorable Mashile. Proceed.
Yes, Chair. I'm really going to take time. I hope that we have the time. I think on... I would have liked if the issue of global warming has been raised up in the order of slide number 6, just together with the MDGs. That is what I would have loved to see Honorable Khumalo. And you know, it's touching back this issue of transfers. What Honorable De Vere has raised, just to add on, is the actual practice of transfer. I'm sure, Mr. Khumalo, you may have heard us the whole of the past years really actually trying to fight with national departments and provincial department. You know, it's all the actual transfers of funds. You have got this tendency of departments refusing to transfer the funds on the basis of their own understanding of performance, or what not, this they have not done, this then we can transfer the next batch of amounts to this local municipality and all those sorts of things. And eventually leading to reallocation of certain municipalities' funds which have not been transferred because of certain problems being allocated to other municipalities, actually changing the distribution of resources, changing totally. And I'm not sure how we can really deal with that, because until to date, of course, is that with the I was told that in the last division of revenue that there are powers that are entrusted to treasury to refuse to transfer if there are certain things that are happening that they are not happy about. But we tried to argue against the intention of allocating the resources to that specific municipality or that specific province or that specific project. It is for development. It is to achieve equality, better life for all citizens of the country. But unfortunately, we have this bureaucratic bungling that funds are refused because a particular municipality has no capacity to do X, Y, Z, and instead of being helped, and then the funds are reallocated to somewhere else. I still believe that that is some work that we need to do, because it is even being used, this refusal to transfer is even being used as a punitive measure to try and ask for performance rather than using other methods, rather than actually refusing the funds. Then the other issue, I'm not sure, is FSC, whether it has actually tried to interrogate this NGP, the New Growth Path, because it is understood that it is a framework which has got acceptable principles, but it is still being panel beaten in NEDLAC. And how does that, as an incomplete policy, to affect the rest of service delivery? And how should we proceed with it in order to assist all other programs to ensure that we have economic growth which will result with jobs? And the one point which on your slide 14, when I understood it, it was almost saying that you must regulate everything. And now, at one time, I think I was told that if you regulate everything, whatever is not regulated, then it becomes a problem. And it becomes a thing not to be complied with, not to be done correctly. Only things that are being regulated. But what I'm understanding there is that we need to give almost guidelines to everything that the municipalities are supposed to be doing. And I'm not sure whether that should be the route. And probably, maybe, I may be convinced. The slide 15. Slide 15 on the peer learning and isn't that SALGA's responsibility? How do we call upon SALGA also to play the role as an organization that is state funded? Because surely for government to engage in trying to learn from a performing municipality to try and impart it to another municipality, when municipalities have got their own association, don't we need to review SALGA's establishment or constitution or advise them, or don't we need to call upon them to really do what they're supposed to do? Because surely it should be in their interest that the municipalities that they represent actually cross-teach each other. And Chair, the presentation made by the other commissioner on Chapter 4, as much as I agree with it a little bit, but I seriously have problems with that. You know, it's any intention that seeks to perpetuate cities actually perpetuate inequality. And unless otherwise there is a parallel equal attention to the rural economy, I will be a little bit difficult to be convinced. Because one believes that it is deliberate attempts that actually changes the status quo. But really to talk, to say that we need to look after the urban economy seriously for sustainable development and economic growth, as if as rural areas we can't do the same. I'm sure there is somewhere around Tabazimbi building hub that is being built there, right in the middle of the rural area. And surely it is going to make a lot of improvement in anything. And why that cannot happen in Kiani? Why it cannot happen in Komazi, in Mpumalanga? Why it can't happen in Piet Retief? Why it can't happen in Ulundi? It is deliberate decisions by people. If we don't do it or we are lazy to do it, then we will follow where there are indications of economic development, and then we go there at the expense of the rest of the country. I will continue. I think we did so in the past as well, especially on the allocations of the division of revenue. Well, I think that's what we have been saying, that let us not forget the rural economies when we allocate these resources for purposes of development. Because if we don't do so, we are actually asking rural people to come to cities. That's what we are doing. And when they come to cities, then we force the cities to complain that now they need extra housing grants, extra what for sewage and for water and all that. And the resources are limited in the cities. So I'm trying to influence your mind that when you look up, when you talk about this chapter 4, at least bring these things that you can create an urban economy in India. Not necessarily Johannesburg or Cape Town or Devon. The other thing is the on the housing. Is it not time that we should consolidate all these funding windows for housing, so that then we can facilitate all modes of provision of housing? Because currently, in a particular municipality, they allocate about, say, 1,000 housing units of RDP houses. And they cannot do anything about that because it must go in different villages for different beneficiaries. And when they have been done, they don't make a difference. It only makes a difference in one family, but it doesn't make a difference in the total housing provision for those that need housing. It just changes the lives of only 5, 6, 7 people that are staying in that little shack. But on your major project of providing houses to the mass of people that need housing, then it is just a drop in the ocean. And because they are all scattered jobs around, is it not really time that all the funding windows can be consolidated? Then make sure that they are located to the correct department to deal with these other issues. The last thing, I just want to talk to bargaining, the wage bargaining, because it has got a lot of negative economic impact, the wages. Who says that government should bargain with the unions only after government has completed the budget? Who is saying that? Is there anybody who says that we can't bargain before the budget is done? The bargaining now for the following year and the budget is done correctly. Who says which one comes first? Because, Chair, I'm really not understanding why, as Treasurer, we say we put budget of 7% for wages of personnel, and the union comes and then they want 18%. And then we are locked in strikes endlessly, which impacts on the economy. Who says we can't engage the unions and budget for the coming years? Why that cannot be done if it can actually solve some of the problems of the unnecessary strife that we find ourselves in. Because definitely it has a lot of impact on the fiscal allocations, it has a problem on the economy, and it has a problem on the morale of ordinary citizens who are supposed to receive services. Some want to go on strike now, everybody is clear what when some goes on strike, what's going to happen with our towns. And, you know, we are not standing on one leg. Is there anything that FFC can do about this thing, or look at this particular matter and study it, or understand what forces government to budget first before it negotiates with the unions, and what will happen if they bargain before the budget is put together, and what will be the outcomes of that kind of sensitive.
Chairperson, thank you very much. The question about the bargaining, I'm not going to repeat it. Thank you, Honorable Machine, to have raised it. Now, my second question is that on page 26, concerning the OSD, since you have discovered this, or you have recommended the formalizing the performance of the evaluation system. In order to strengthen this recommendation, did you approach the treasurer to come up with a figure the figure used in making this the blanket giving out of the OSD that will give you the proper figure, so that when because you are coming with a very good system that no, the payment could only be done after the performance evaluation of a person in order to get that incentive, not a blanket OSD. Is the treasury in position to give the total figure for the proper financial year that no, where we spent so much, if we come to the performance system, we will save so many millions. Thank you.
Undertaking that by December, that bridge will be complete this December. We went there and there was nothing, and money has been allocated. And Now, my second example is about building of power. The presenter indicates to us that what they had done consciously or unconsciously, they had built more houses than necessary. Which means in essence that they did not follow their business plan that is wrong. And that two, there was an over concentration of the building of houses in one area. And that it looked like a frantic effort to dispatch with the money, with the funds, before the financial year end, so that we can be able to move. It clearly shows that there was no problem. And if you probe more, you could have found that probably it is the same construction company that has been given the time. I'm saying every time we go, whether it's a frustration or finance or taking parliament, you see this type of thing taking place. And nobody can investigate this question. Obviously, if the Office of the Public Protector does not know anything about it, they all know that the certain municipality has flouted all the rules, including the Finance Management Act and everything. They wouldn't know. Now, even ourselves, when we go as a committee and do those ask them questions, and we see, obviously, that there is a lot of promise going on in this particular way. It becomes very clear in terms of what is in our system and what is in it. I'm trying to get at the point at which the program for taking parliament and committee work could be able to make a difference in the people's lives. So, what leverage is there to the committee and to parliament as well? Parliament goes there, it has been explained. And does it mean we are going to do this over and over and over again without somebody saying, why don't you call the public? Because that is within the ambit of the committee. The committee has the power. The committee also has the power to call and sit down with the NPA, give the report so that the NPA must be able to. But the manner in which we are moving, it's a roller coaster. We just go there, we see the wastage of the money. Then we report to Parliament, and the report gathers dust. And we just go on, and we report, we gather dust. We want to see ourselves making a difference in the system and making sure that this gets the same point. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, honorable members. I will allow the FSC to respond, but I'm sure you'll appreciate that some of the things that you have raised are a little bit off the report as tabled, but it is up to the FSC to respond to those issues, because some really would need to be discussed elsewhere. But it is quite clear that we might also not be able to exhaust our discussion on some of the things. Well, some will have to find a if you have got anything, when you will also have an opportunity to do so. But before I give over, I just wanted to clarify myself, or maybe to Honorable Mashile, particularly on this issue of the bargaining process. Whether it should happen before the budget is completed or after. I know at some point I shared the same view, but on looking into the matter deeply, I couldn't find as to how it will assist the bargaining process. Particularly because you get into those particular processes knowing what you have. So if people say no, government should engage first before, then I don't see how it will assist the process, because government will be getting into those particular processes, and whatever that they agree will be subject to the income that government would have received. And in a broad sense, it actually would nullify the processes of bargaining, because it will require that from the start of the budgeting process, government will have to bring on board labor in those particular processes until the final stage, which then at that time would hope that there will be process. So it means it will be like essentially calling for a joint budgeting process with labor. Get the entire team into the processes, because it's quite an involved process, taking into consideration everything that the country has to do, its responsibility and everything. But I'm saying, because that is a debate that we might not do justice to now, but it's something that we need to, as you continue to engage on this, begin to say, how will it help, and why are we saying, because currently we are only saying this current setup is not good, because government would have budgeted 10%, and then labor knows well in advance, they know we don't want 100%, we'll push them to 13%, and afterwards they will have to be shipped there and there and there and there. That's the only point. Other than that point, what else is problematic with the current system vis-a-vis, and what would be better if we negotiate, other than to say, at least if we agree on 10% before we finalize the budget, then in the budget we'll adopt 12%. There will not be any need to do the shifting. That is a counter product in terms of counter end results in terms of what is happening now and what would happen. But so we will have to look beyond only those two elements. What if again we have agreed on 12%? But when we do the actual budget, we found that the government won't be able to afford the 12%. Should the government renege from the agreement and say, no, we have agreed, but we never anticipated that we'll collect lower, and therefore we can't give that? And what would be the result? I'm not saying we should discuss that now, because we only have got 30. I'm not provoking your thoughts, comrade. Come again?
I thought maybe it could have been better if you didn't make any comment. Can we really just say that? Then amongst us in the study group, we can argue.
Okay. Now I'm just provoking your thinking, so that when we go to those particular study group, at least we move. I know you. Let me take the advice of
as you say, that it's going to be a debate that's going to go for quite a long time, and definitely that's why I believe that FLC should have interest in the matter, because this current situation has got a serious negative impact on anything that we try to do.
No, it's fine.
And now what one is saying is, if government can deal with what we call the 3-year cycle, the NTS, And in those, it has built in certain increases to personnel salary in the 3 years. And then now the question that arises is, why don't they then do things differently? Because the current situation, of course, Chair, for the past couple of years, is that they have the increases have averaged above what government has budgeted. And for some reason, if you move from the premise that the government basket of money is constant. So in other words, is that if government has budgeted for 5% increase, and then the average increase gets to 7%, it only means that resources will have now to be stolen from other projects or programs to fund these. And then it ends up frustrating the rest of what we are trying to do that we beg you to do. So surely if that is the situation, people with minds cannot just simply see it. They will have to really try and do something to correct the thing as far as it is possible. Thank you.
Okay. I think those two things are noted, but it's something that maybe FSC will be interested, including Treasury, to look into going forward. Let me, within the remaining, tea was ready an hour ago, so if you want tea, you can grab it. Otherwise, we are targeting to be closing in 30 minutes time from now on. I don't know when you want to come in before I give the FFC. If there is anything for myself, and then the FFC after.
Okay, thank you for that. Maybe just some general responses, because I think that's quite important. The FFC annually makes its recommendations on the Division of Revenue, next year's Division of Revenue. What National Treasury then does is we consolidate national government's view. So what we don't present is National Treasury's view. When we submit the budget in February, we've actually taken into account what's come out of these hearings. We've also discussed and got the inputs from the various sector departments and interrogated it with the sector departments responsible, and that is what actually then gets presented. Then a second, I think, important point to make is that when the FFC does its annual division of revenue, there are certain decisions that's got fiscal responses, which the fiscus can respond to, some of them immediately and some of them in the longer term. To give an example, the FFC has made a recommendation that we look at how can we actually collect more readily available information with respect to municipalities. Yes, some of those recommendations are very sound, but they can only be implemented in the longer term. For example, if you want to actually use information that's collected on municipal level that's verified, currently some municipalities, the bigger ones in particular, can collect information quite well, and they can even appoint consultants that can do it for R1 million or so, and they can have the most up-to-date data, where smaller municipalities currently, they even struggle just to do budgets. Now, if you want to put information into a system and ensure that all municipalities are treated equitably, all the information must be available for all municipalities, it must be of the same quality, and all the data must be verified. We're definitely not at that stage yet. Most probably we'll get there over time. And just for members' information, there is currently a process underway between National Treasury, the Department of Cooperative Governance, the FFC, and SAT-SA to actually explore how can we actually look at potentially updating data. But it's not necessarily just a data issue. It could even require the formula to be changed. So we need to look at all those options. When those work is finished, we can always present it to this committee. For your information. Then with regard to certain other decisions of a policy nature, and the reason why I mention this is very important is because some of those decisions is not fiscal responses, it's made by sector departments, such as the issue that's mentioned about scholar transport. So what would be best in these type of situations is to actually call the sector departments responsible, that there would be the National Department of Transport and the National Department of Basic Education to actually make their presentations to the committee, to actually get the information that informs that decision. Because the fiscal, it's not a fiscal issue that can be dealt with. It's purely a sector issue. And after the policy decisions have been clarified, then the fiscus can respond. It links up to a point that the FCC made earlier on as well, with regard to some of the challenges that we experience in the system about housing, for example. Just to explain some of the complexity. Some of those decisions and warehouses are located. It's not a municipal decision. Some of them build the houses, but the province that's actually currently authorized for the housing service actually determines where they actually place the houses. But municipalities then must pick up the tab for public transport and to actually provide the services like water and sanitation in far located areas. Some of those challenges to be addressed is to locate the function for housing appropriately. And in those cases, for example, housing should be located with the municipalities, particularly the metros and larger ones. So there's bigger policy issues there that needs to be resolved, and the fiscus cannot resolve those issues. Then with regard to the transfer issue, if I can ask Honourable De Beer to provide me with more information with respect to that specific municipality, because currently our transfer system doesn't work with national treasury transfers to the provincial treasury, and then it goes to DECOP, and then it goes to the municipality. There's two types of transfers that go to local government. The one is the equitable share. The transfer date for the equitable share, there's three tranches. It's contained in the division of revenue, and it must be transferred on those dates. If it's not transferred, then there's a serious concern. What we've picked up, for example, what sometimes happens is municipality changes bank accounts. It doesn't inform National Treasury that it's changed its banking account. Then the money gets transferred into a debt account, and then the money gets reverted, and then it gets fixed after a later stage. That could potentially be one of the challenges. With regard to municipal infrastructure grant money, again, there's a payment schedule that gets approved in the beginning of the year, and transfers must be transferred to. We just released the money, or the fiscus releases the money to DECOP on the payment date, and they should transfer immediately. So that's why I'm asking if I can get more details, we can explore what went wrong there if it's 4 months, because it should not happen like that. Then with regard to the only point I'm going to make with regard to the 3-year cycle of the salary negotiations, the appropriate department that's the lead in government that deals with the issue is not National Treasury, it's the National Department of the Public Service Department that deals with that. And they have the face of government and responsible for leading that. So it could be quite useful then to call them in to actually deal with these issues as well. Of course, with National Treasury as well, because of the budget implication. Thanks.
Any follow-ups? Any other responses from HSC before we break for tea?
Yeah, just a few observations. The main, on the issue of bargaining and the sequencing, our understanding from the Commission side is that the bargaining process is a 3-year agreement. It's aligned. It should necessarily be aligned to the MTF of government. So ordinarily, one would expect that the only adjustments are made like in the outer years. So whether it's appropriately sequenced would basically have a historical implication on how then on an annual basis negotiations take place. Now, I must say here that that's for provincial and national government. For local government, there's a different process, which is led by SAUGA instead of the Department of Public Service and Administration. One of the requirements in that piece of legislation, which was amended, it's in terms of the Municipal Systems Act, the most recent amendment to that Act, specifically Section 71, requires that the FFC be in moment, and really on matters of protecting the fiscal and the macroeconomic, in terms of our interpretation as the Commission, that's what it means. At the moment, we are still in a process of having some discussions with SALGA, because SALGA, before they embarked on the collective bargaining exercise, they must consult the Financial and Fiscal Commission and the Minister of Cooperative Governance. So that's a new thing in that process that has been introduced, much to the quite a significant opposition to that process by municipalities, I must say. But that is now the law. So we are actually currently involved in SALGA to try and negotiate a process on how we are actually going to handle that, because what they have at the moment, which is what you probably are referring to, is the fact that there has been an agreement, which was a multi-year agreement between SALGA which was just about to be finalized, and then the president signed this amendment into law, and then after that, SALGA, the SAMU then came back and wanted to move the goalposts or something. That's in terms of what we picked up from SALGA. So there were certain issues that SAMU raised, which have resulted in the current deadlock, which obviously implies that SAMU have then put in a notice to go on strike, I think from the 15th, if I'm not mistaken. I can't remember what the actual date is that they will be going on strike. So obviously there are issues that even from the Commission side, we will then have to capacitate ourselves to understand how those issues are actually dealt with. And also we'll have to ensure that in terms of how we deal with this consultation process between SALGA and the Commission, that process does not necessarily ignore the fact that those facts that we'll be basing our process on, it should not preclude the unions to actually understand what actually drives certain positions. And those are really issues that you are speaking to about the fiscus and how one then deals with issues of negotiation on the one side, plus given the fiscal constraint and the macroeconomic framework over the medium term and all of that. So those are things that we are currently trying to deal with. Now, with respect to the national and provincial level, as Wendy said, it's the DPSA that drives that process. For us, as a commission, we don't really have anything to do with it, except our engagement with the MTEF process in terms of our annual recommendations. On the issue of the role of SALGA in terms of slide 15, I think I agree with you that SALGA basically has a significant part to play in facilitating the peer learning, and our we have already made a presentation to SALGA, National Executive Committee, on the recommendations, and I think my sense from the discussions that ensued there, they are quite in support of this particular issue, and the role they appreciate what role SALGA must actually play in this process. Now, from our perspective, it's the support, it's the broader support that national and provincial government must then be able to provide to SALGA. You know, some of our discussions with SALGA indicate also that they also have challenges with their own allocation from government. So in terms of resources and revenue, they also are faced with some challenges around that, and some of the work that they would otherwise want to do, they cannot do because of fiscal constraints. So those are discussions that they must have with whoever is responsible for, I suppose, it's the Department of Cooperative Governance. Now, all we're saying is that it's a comprehensive effort by the three spheres of government to assist in that kind of a process, not necessarily saying, let's leave SALGA out of it. On the issue of the rural economy, versus the urban areas, in specifically in respect of Chapter 4 of the submission, I think we need to say it up front here that the focus of that Uwe, you are building new places. It's all going out. And the people invariably that inhabit those areas tend to be the poor people that probably arrive in the urban area because of the urbanization process and the bright light effect of thinking that if you go to the city, that's where you're going to get a job, which is what I think you're concerned about. It's a process that is actually happening, unfortunately, that people are moving from the rural areas into the urban areas in search of jobs. And what happens is that where there is an empty space, people put in these informal settlements in the urban periphery, and suddenly we formalize those. But the people that are there are probably people that are not even working or are looking for a job. And they are going to look for a job in the city, and the city is 25, 30 kilometers away where the economic activity is, where the access or perceived access to the benefits that you get from sitting in the city. It's all of those things. Now, the model that basically generated the recommendations there is a model that basically uses real data from the 6 metros in South Africa. Now, if we add the new metros that have been added, for example, looking at, I think if one looks at the report that the Cities Network published recently, and you look at a metropolitan area like Mangaung, which is a new metro, and look at how it is actually developing and how it is actually growing, then you will basically pick up the kind of problem that we're talking about. It's about making sure that there's connectivity, infrastructure, to areas that are as far or now go beyond Utabelo, and you're sitting somewhere in Bloemfontein, which is where people must actually move to actually get a job, and it's the poor people that basically bear the brunt of that invariably. And therefore, in terms of the issues around equity that we're talking about, unemployment and all of that, those are the people that actually bear the brunt of these sprawling urban areas that we're talking about. Now, there's issues around global warming to link it to your first point, which I agree with, that it's a very important area that needs a lot of work. And I must say that in terms of the work on climate change that we have done here, that was the initial piece, we are actually looking at the rural municipalities as well in the current work cycle, picking up what are the issues that one looks at. So there's a carbon footprint issue related to public transport in a sprawling urban area versus a compact urban area. That if you look at the numbers, I think there are figures in the document there, looking at how much you can actually save over a period of 10 years if you adopt a compact as opposed to a sprawling urban environment. So there's quite significant savings that can be made simply on the basis of the 4 metros that we, of the 6 metros that we currently have, which is what the model was built on. So you can then try and put in the new ones that have recently come on board, and the savings could actually be massive, and the impact on the poor, which is what we're really trying to be concerned about, would also be reduced. The poor actually spend a very high proportion of their income that they earn on public transport in South Africa than anywhere else in the world. And that's an indictment for an economy where we are actually saying that the issue of inequality and poverty is a primary priority of government in terms of addressing the problems that face the country. On the housing funding, I was hoping that Wendy was going to say a little bit about some of the initiatives that are actually taking place around what must actually happen, especially following certain decisions that have been taken around the accreditation of municipalities. I don't know whether Wendy, you might want to come back to that. And then the other issue that was raised that I thought was probably Wendy can respond to as well, but I can say from our perspective, it's the issue around the OSD, occupation-specific dispensation. is that what I want to raise here is that, in terms of our submission, is that there is a significant level of concern in the Commission about the nature that OSP has actually taken against what the original intention around OSP was. OSP was introduced to deal with a specific problem relating to scarce skills in certain areas. And there were those areas that have been identified as requiring this kind of an intervention. Now, in terms of its rollout at the beginning, there were mistakes that had actually been made both at the provincial and at the national level in the relevant departments. And I would say the Department of Health and Department of Education. So there was a lot of mistakes that were made by provinces in the rolling out of the implementation of OSD. And that actually did put a significant amount of pressure on the budgets. And because this OSD is money that is allocated and then it's transferred with your equitable share, it becomes part and parcel of your pool of revenue. And now, given the fungibility of funds, how do we know, how do we guarantee that this money that has been allocated for OSD is actually sufficient, especially given the environment in which we are operating, where almost every sector, the most recent that I heard about OSD coming into play was correctional services or something like that. There's some OSD issues in correctional services. So now, instead of OSD being a program that is looking or focused at specific skills that are scarce and retaining specific skills and incentivizing those areas, it has now become institutionalized as something that is part and parcel of the bargaining process. It's no longer a specific targeted government program to address a specific problem that has been identified. So it's now institutionalized as part and parcel of the bargaining, collective bargaining process, to an extent that in certain areas, the bargaining process even says, no, we want money for OSD, but we don't want these assessments that you're talking about. Now that becomes quite a problematic issue, because it then defeats the whole purpose for which this program was intended. So what we are raising here is not about the money, what is the amount that has gone through there. I think Treasury would be in a better position to talk about what the amount is that has actually gone there. And then maybe for somebody to look at the original thinking behind it and see whether or not we are actually doing what we set out to do from the beginning. I think that is the more important issue from the Commission's perspective, because otherwise, if it's a collective bargaining issue, then it's no longer a targeted program of government to address a specific issue around personnel in the public sector. Tanya, you can add your own. Oh, sorry, let me just say on the NGP, it's a very long story, but to cut it short, we can, for this particular committee, come and present to you our own interpretation of the NGP in the context of the FFC and what it is that it means, irrespective of the other discussions that are taking place on the implementation and rollout, because what we're more concerned about is what the impact, the financial and fiscal implications and the impact of the NGP are in the current way in which it was tabled. We have actually made a presentation. We briefed the standing committee, portfolio committee on economic development on that particular issue, and I don't think that there's